That was a little bit louder than I expected. Oh, welcome back. It's so good to see your faces, and we'll have time at the end of the talk so that I want to hear from some of you how this meditation landed. So I wanted to explore a little bit more about embodiment and the Dharma continuum. And this notion of the Dharma continuum, I chose those words because life, the essence of life is a constant movement. We have all kinds of perceptual distortions, from feeling ourselves as a separate entity to somehow thinking that things are going to be stable and static. But in many ways, the word Dharma, which we identify as describing the teachings, our Buddhist teachings, Dharma ultimately is sort of like the way it is. In a way, Dharma expresses the way life manifests. And life manifests as a constant movement, constant motion. One of the indigenous teachers I've been aware of, Arkhan Lushwala, says, humans belong to the movement of life and we adapt to it. So there are many reasons why we don't necessarily experience ourselves as part of this ongoing flow of living, that we don't recognize the continuum of the Dharma itself. And so here we're meeting on Great Wheel Day, 26,000 years after the Buddha gave the teachings on the Four Noble Truths, which describe how the way we perceive, how we're living, how this life happens, and how we relate to it involves a lot of suffering. And that there is a cause for the suffering. And that cause has something to do with the way we actually perceive, with the way we feel ourselves as a separate entity with this solid sense of self that's disconnected from the whole. And that we don't experience ourselves as the continuum of life itself, which we are. So, in many ways, our practice and the Four Noble Truths say, there is this suffering because of the way we're living and perceiving, and there's a cause for that suffering, which has to do with this misperception, and then our grasping desperately to try and have things be the way we need them to be, and that there's a way out of this kind of suffering. And ultimately, he set out the path, the Eightfold Path, as the way for us to find our way out of that suffering. The practice in itself involves a training of the mind and a refining of our perception. And so, with the foundations of mindfulness, we start with, mindfulness of the body. It's all through the physical experience. Mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of feeling tone, mindfulness of thoughts and the mental processes. We become acutely aware and can track this process. So we're harnessing the mind to be able to attend to the direct experience and get to know what that experience is. And if we back off a little bit, and just I'd like to speak a little bit about how we start as babies, that when we are first born, unless there's tremendous trauma and we're in distress, the mind is completely open. because there isn't even the neurology to make thoughts. So there's just this profound openness that in many ways is similar to the openness that happens with realization. Except, you know, in a baby, we don't have the experience nor the maturity, all of that, but there are qualities of that that are similar. And then as we begin to accumulate experience, you know, the impact of how we're being cared for, not cared for so well or whatever, you know, all of these imprints, little by little, you know, are registered first just somatically and emotionally, but eventually, you know, the thinking process begins and we begin to put things together and make thoughts and notions in our mind that try and explain to ourselves why things are the way they are, or try and learn our way. And as we begin to build this whole conceptual framework, and because of we're not living in enlightened families where adults around us can reflect back that ground that is non-conceptual, little by little, as we accumulate all the concepts, we identify and we start to feel like those concepts are what we are. And so this identity that the Buddha is describing, this sense of a separate self, is something that we make up as a survival strategy when we don't have support to stay connected to our ground. So it has a very unstable and kind of anxious quality to it. And so then we proceed to try and arrange our world the way we want it, you know, so that we have safety, that we have security, that we have the food, that we have the love, all of that. So there's this sort of, in Theravada, they talk about this craving, but it's this, in a way, scrambling to try and stabilize our life without the wisdom of the ground of being. And beyond the predicament of just our own process of development, there are all sorts of ways, you know, in which we're impacted by the cultures that we've been living in. And so after living under cultures of domination for a very, very long time at this point, we have, you know, cultures of domination have certain impacts on people, which means, you know, often disconnecting from the earth, disconnecting from the body, disconnecting from our sense of being part of the continuum of life. If we look at indigenous cultures, and for example, going back all the way to the original people in the Kalahari Desert, those people could walk the landscape with a sort of panoramic sense of what was there, and they were in union with the whole thing because they could hear the birds, and they knew what the birds were saying, and the birds in the trees were describing what was going on underneath, so they knew where the dangerous animals would be. They walked through the landscape being part of it and being informed by it. So this piece about being informed by the landscape is something that we have lost. And right now, with the state of our world, and you know, many of us, whether by helping professions or teaching and so on, you know, we keep looking at what is it that's needed for this moment? What kind of support do we need to meet what we're having to face? And so I have become more and more convinced that this regaining of full embodiment is part of, in a way, empowering ourselves back so that we can actually meet the moment. And so besides, you know, the disconnection, traditionally, you know, with indigenous cultures, people had the support of the natural world. You know, and the natural world doesn't have a discursive mind. So I'm sure many of you go to the natural world as refuge. And there's a peace and a calm that can come over us. It's almost getting that reference point again of the non-discursive quality of being that's in the natural world. And yet, for some of us, depending on how we're situated within a particular culture, we may not always get such a positive reflection from the greater culture. So then we have the added burden of how we're being received by the culture. And in many marginalized communities, there's this added stress, either from racism and all the prejudice about body and ability and class and gender and sexual orientation, all of these things that in many ways, this new generation is really pushing us to look at and explore. But the culture itself is organized in a way that impacts certain people disproportionately. So then when we come to our practice, this healing that's needed in how we're relating to our own physicality is very much at the heart of what our practice needs to address. And I can tell you that by this meditation that we just did today, just going through the body and appreciating it and thanking it very precisely over and over and over can really transform not only the way we feel about our bodies, but the sense of agency and possibilities that we have. And so I have begun to feel that this re-embodying ourselves fully is key to developing the capacity we need for this moment. Some of you might have noticed, even when you turn to look at the empty quality of the mind, as you turn, you may notice that that is facilitated by having the entire body awake and aware. Many times when I'm in that deep meditation, I feel like even my toes are participating in the meditation. Everything is on. Everything is awake and perceiving. And this entire body is the organ of perception that awakened mind has to be here for, with. An awakened mind is in all of us, is in everything. And awakened mind is experiencing itself through the physicality. So the body is the instrument for perception for awakened mind. So disregarding one leg, ignoring a foot, we're kind of handicapped. We don't, not every cell is on board for the learning and for the perception that needs to happen. So it might be counterintuitive to realize that by actually embodying more, we're more capable of opening to the empty quality in the mind, the non-conceptual awareness within which all of our experience is happening. That non-conceptual awareness is in everything, and it's the source of the entire manifested world. And we, as human beings, can become aware of that ground. And when that starts to open up, it changes our life. It empowers us in a way that nothing else will. And it gives perspective to understand life in a totally new way. This is a pivotal insight. And you start to then understand the limitations of language, the limitations of labels. Because the minute we go into language, we are abstracting ourselves from the direct experience. So when we are using the entire body, there's an immediacy to our experience. In some of different traditions, and particularly in Zen, they say enlightenment is intimacy with all things. sometimes when we're meditating, you may have memories of being a child, you know, being really young, and just feeling your little body just being so intimate with, I don't know, watching the ants walk on the ground or hearing a bird. I remember my granddaughter one time heard a robin for the first time. She goes, "What's that?" You know, it's like this amazing, "Ah, what's that?" So then began this whole exploration about robins and going to listen to the robins. So that kind of exquisite intimacy is something that can be regained. It's our birthright to be in that related, in that relationship with all that surrounds us. And before, I wanted to say, I mean, there's healing that needs to be done, you know, especially when we are addressing the body. For some of us, it's tricky, you know, how we approach the body, how we befriend it, how we come back home to it. And so as we do that little by little, the nervous system calms down. As the nervous system calms down, we are more open to the unconditioned. But so this is all within our own experience. But then the second piece is how we recognize the interrelatedness of everything. Since everything is arising out of the same ground, our lives take place within a single sphere of awareness that includes everything. And we live in a relational world that is often not recognized. I remember when I went from practicing regular Western medicine to osteopathy, and I learned that there was a balance of tension in the body, for example. And if a toe twisted, you know, something might shift in the head, and the whole thing was in a balance of tension. So every part of the body is relating to everything else. And some of those relationships were transmitted through the fascial system. So if we think about our relationship with the atmosphere, our bodies, if we were not in a balance of tension with the atmosphere, our bodies would either explode or they would be totally compressed. But we're in this very fine-tuned balance of tension with the atmosphere. So when the barometric pressure changes, you know, some of us will get headaches or joint aches and so on, just from a few degrees of difference. And like that, what holds the planets and the moons in orbit, how the solar systems work within a galaxy, the entire universe, is everything is relating to everything else. And here we are, feeling ourselves as this discrete unit that's somehow disconnected from everything. So no wonder we suffer. And the way back is through the body and the mind being utilized to recognize not only its empty nature, but to appreciate its embodiment. They go hand in hand. And this relatedness is so beautifully expressed by Dogen, who is the originator of Soto Zen. And some of you have heard this over and over and over because I've been working with this for years now, but I'm going to offer it again today. And what's special about Dogen's Bendawa, the wholehearted way, is that, first of all, his Zazen was sitting in the recognition of that empty ground. And so from that, there's a level of insight that's profound, and that's way beyond just what the discursive mind can perceive. But there are aspects of not only the relatedness, but how it all works together and helps each other. So he says, there's a path through which the incomparable awareness of all things, returns to the person in Zazen, and whereby that person and the enlightenment of all things intimately and imperceptibly assist each other. Grasses and trees, fences and walls demonstrate and exalt it for the sake of living beings, both ordinary and sage. And in turn, living beings, both ordinary and sage, express and unfold it for the sake of grasses and trees, fences and walls. These various mutual influences do not mix into the perception of the person sitting, because they take place within stillness without any fabrication, and they are enlightenment itself. Even if only one person sits for a short time, because this Zazen is one with all existence and completely permeates all time, it performs everlasting Buddha guidance within the inexhaustible Dharma world in the past, present, and future. Zazen is equally the same practice and the same enlightenment for both the person sitting and all dharmas. And in the footnotes, the active realization embodied and supported in self-fulfilling samadhi includes not only humans and other creatures, but even the land and soil, the grasses and trees, fences and walls, tiles and pebbles that Dogen mentions. Even things usually considered inanimate objects in Western philosophy vitally partake of this awakening and mutually resonate to encourage the subtle, mysterious Buddha guidance or influence in all of us. So when we read Dogen, we see that is he's describing the continuum of the Dharma. It's uninterrupted. And not only it's uninterrupted, it has qualities within its flow that are reciprocal. There's a responsive quality within this flow of awareness, so that a problem arises, and what addresses the problem, many times we see it co-arising, so that there's this constant play of all that's manifesting, optimizing function. And some of us may say, well, what's happening in our world right now with this possibility of this living Dharma continuum and all the horrors that we're seeing and have been, you know, throughout time? And that is what the Buddha was trying to address, that we have lost perception, we have lost capacity to understand, and that there is a way back. And the way back is through our practice. And my desire this evening is to say, to advocate for the embodiment piece of our practice. Sometimes we can, in a way, disown the body, because in very, very deep states of absorption, we can almost like not even feel the body. There's just this pristine wakefulness that goes beyond the physicality. But we're not walking around like that. And more often than not, people kind of disown the body, and that's not real freedom either. And by being fully embodied, we're empowered to practice at a very deep level. So it's possible to fully enjoy the physicality and the empty, blissful quality of our essential being. And I think I'll stop there so that we can flesh this out a little bit together. And I thank you for your attention so far. So what we'll do is, I think we'll have people, Emiko, do you think it's workable to have people raise their hand, or if you have a question or a comment or?
Yes, if folk want to raise their virtual hand using the reactions button at the bottom of your Zoom screen, and if you have any problems with that, feel free to chat me. And you can also chat me and I can read what you have to say out loud as well.
And I just want to say, a lot of teaching happens with your questions and going back and forth, or with your comments, so that we take whatever has been offered and we open it up together. So it's very valuable that you participate.
It looks like somebody might be having a hard time with the hand raised feature. Jim, I can bring you up if you wanted to speak into the room. Oh, here we go. I'm trying to unmute you now.
There you go. Hello.
Hi. So I have a question.
Okay.
This is
yes.
Jim.
Okay. Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about death and grief?
Death and grief, what about it? What would you like? What are you wondering about?
Well, I'm wondering, how does it fit in?
Can you get a little closer to the
microphone? The whole continuum of life.
Yeah, the continuum. How does death and grief fit into the continuum? You know, birth and death are, you know, we depending on your practice, you know, in the Theravadan tradition, we don't talk so much about reincarnation. In the Tibetan tradition, we do. And so that a mind stream experiences more than one life. And so the points of emerging into physicality and then going off again are intense moments. And in our human life, they're probably some of the most powerful experiences we have. And the fear of death is something that most of us struggle with. And so in many ways, people speak about the practice as a way to actually, through the practice itself, to come to terms with our own ending, with our own death. And in terms of grief, all experience, whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, blissful, terrible, the freedom, our freedom lies on being able to open to it. And so when there's grief, to actually make room in our hearts for that grief and not have to package ourselves and have it be some other way. And if it gets overwhelming, then we sort of back off and open to the fact that we're overwhelmed and we need to put some boundaries on it. And so whatever is going on in our direct experience, the freedom lies in opening our hearts to what it is. And so if we're in conflict, then we back off the conflict and we open our heart to the fact that we're in conflict. If we're lost, we recognize and open our heart to the fact that we're lost, that we feel lost. Grief is part of life. And we need to be able to grieve. There's no freedom without grief and without being able to grieve. And we have a lot of dictums that come from the cultures we live in that allow this but don't allow that. Meanwhile, our life unfolds with everything in it. So part of our predicament is being imprisoned by convention. And, you know, taking that as the way to be. And so through the practice, you start to gain a little bit of freedom and recognize some of those dictums that don't serve you. Does this help you? Okay, thank you. Oh, there's Taisha and Nina. There's Taisha. Oh my gosh, I haven't seen you in so long.
Hi, Marita. It's so nice to see you. I love you and thank you for everything. I'm moved and shattered by what you said earlier about our relationship to land being formed or informed by the landscape. And what shatters me is just what it means to be living in city life and the built environment. And I guess I just wonder if you could share some thoughts about how we recover that absence of connection to the natural world, the unbuilt environment, or is it an opportunity to be inside of grief, thinking about the last question?
That's a great question, Taisha. I have explored a lot with that. You know, it's wonderful when we can get out to the natural world and just, you know, put our feet on the earth and hold on to a tree or a branch, or, you know, just physically be in the presence of the natural world and notice the quality of the natural world. And, you know, it could just be a tree outside your home. It doesn't even have to be like the entire landscape. More than anything is how we open ourselves to the intimacy of that relationship. I started, you know, after doing a lot of home retreats and walking the planks, you know, these old beat up wooden floors. And I started to thank the wooden planks for holding me and putting my hand on the wall and thanking the house for holding me all these years and just entering into a relationship of gratitude for the place that holds me. Walking outside this morning, seeing a little, for the first time after 25 years, there's a brown towhee nesting, making a nest. She's busy every morning making a nest in a little bush. And I hope the scrub jays don't get her. But that intimacy, you know, it's our ability to appreciate and enter into the dialogue. The natural world is wonderful. But I can tell you, just like Dogen says, every object is broadcasting Buddha nature because it all comes from the same ground. Whether we made it or it's plastic or whatever, everything is arising from the empty nature. So it's the way we're relating to it. And that's what, in a way, you're asking the question that I was trying to address today that at the end didn't feel so articulate. Sometimes I'm more articulate than others. But really what I wanted to say is that there's a way in which the physicality of our world can be tremendous support. Our ability to love and appreciate the chair we're sitting, the walls that hold us, that kind of gratitude for what's being provided to support this mind, this heart, this body, that kind of gratitude opens doors that nothing else will. And then we start to experience a certain kind of strength derived from the support that's coming from the physicality of life. which is very different from just going into the emptiness and in many ways excarnating. This is really coming in. And so through the physicality and experiencing that, while experiencing that, the mind can open to full emptiness while feeling the physicality of the body at the same time. And that is really powerful. I mean, if you think of a warrior for these times, that is what a warrior for these times would be. Totally embodied and aware of the empty nature at the same time. So thank you for the question, because that's exactly what I needed to accomplish and I hadn't done it. Good to see you. Nina.
Thank you so much for your wise words. Your meditation moved me to tears, because touching my body. And I can see how continuing that practice will be of so much benefit to myself. My question is that, did the Buddha ever give a hint to as to what happened? Why do we have that separation?
Separation from the body, you mean?
Yes.
Well, you know, I'm stepping into tender territory here. Because, you know, just like now, there were politics then. And, you know, the Buddha, like when he taught about the emptiness, empty nature of the mind, a lot of people walked off and were very angry because it was such an affront to the ego. And so the more dogmatic types wanted to go by the rule, you know, by the dogma. And eventually, if you see into the empty nature of the original mind, you realize that even all our teachings, they're skillful means, but they're not the ultimate truth. And if you get too tight with them, they bind your mind just like ordinary thinking. If you get too attached to them. So we, you know, the teachings come down through cultures. And sometimes it's hard to know to separate the pristine teaching from the cultural wrapping. And something that we don't often say, you know, this has all come down through a patriarchal lens also. And so there are qualities of the feminine that are missing. And so the separation from the body, I think, also has a lot to do with the cultures of domination. That's, you know, aside from the way the teachings have come down, the cultures of dominations have existed for eons. In India, you know, all over. You know, people were subjugated in order to serve, you know, a higher class or so on and so on. So in that process, and people were abstracted or moved from the land that they originally were in, you know, originally we were all indigenous to the areas that we came from. And then over time, as the cultures of domination and conquest developed, you know, people were starting migrating and being uprooted from the land and then uprooted from the earth. And you know, there's a lot there. Women, you know, need to produce and just procreate. And so the devaluing of the women's role, that in many indigenous societies, the women's role is just in par with the masculine role. So we have the teachings, and then we have all the cultural contexts within which the teachings have evolved.
So would you also say that then that's also a separation from our animal nature?
We could say it that way. I mean, I, you know, our, we say, there's such a connotation about animal, you know, in Western culture, like, or even, right. just like an right. animal is seen as a very, you know, way lesser and so on, but it's our embodied nature, you know?
Right.
I'll tell another story from my granddaughter. She was 6 years old and we're in the car and she wants me to go buy a Barbie somewhere. And I said, no. So we'll take her to the beach. We get to the beach and the ocean, the water was really low tide, had receded. And all of a sudden there were all these starfish exposed and all of this. And she came, it was just like a little animal, like a little deer in their excitement, and started doing cartwheels along the edge of the water. I mean, take a few breaths and more. And she just went along. And I thought, you know, life wants to live through that little body, enjoying its excitement. That is a free state of being. We as adults, we lose that capacity to enjoy and to participate without necessarily having to fulfill a function. Mm-hmm. Just enjoyment. Awakened mind likes to enjoy itself through physicality.
Thank you.
Joe Casey, a couple of people. Joe Casey, there you are. Hi.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you well. Thank you.
Cool. I appreciated your guided meditation tonight. Thank you. Question I have around is whenever I kind of get into that radical open space, I get a little scared.
Yes.
Yes. It's a little scary. I don't know where I'm going to land. I don't know how it's going to play out. Is that, I'm assuming that's normal.
Absolutely. You know, the fact that you get scared lets me know that you're there. And the reason we get scared, there's very little support, you know, for this. And we get scared because our ego, you know, we construct this identity. Just our identity is a pile of our past experience kind of glued together, kind of precariously, you know, and we think we're that. And then when you open to the emptiness, this gets really nervous. It's like, oh, now what? You know, like, what's going to happen? You know, how am I going to, I remember thinking, how am I going to relate to my family? Like, how am I going to relate to anybody? How am I going to work if I really open to this, you know? And what I would say is just do it for little short periods. It's almost like you're training yourself. It's like training wheels, you know, little bits at a time, frequently. And after a while, you'll get more comfortable. And what you will find eventually is that having access to that first, you know, I had it in compartments. Now I'm in there, and then now I'm all embroiled in stuff. And then now I'm in there, you know, so they were in compartments. Eventually, what you see is that you start to recognize that ground as what you actually are. And then from there, you just function and you do what you have to do. And in fact, you get so much more efficient and effective, because when we got the narrow vision of being totally identified, we don't see all the options. We have limited options. When we open the view like that, you see way more options. Generally, the choices you make are way more informed and better. And yeah, there's another description for enlightenment was from an appropriate response. Most of the time we're reactive. We're not having an appropriate response. We're all tangled up. When this opens up and you respond to whatever events, anything ordinary, you just so much freer to be appropriate, you know, not overreacting and not dismissing, but just right there with what's needed. It arises from within. You don't import it from somewhere else. It's arising within you. So little bits at a time, often. Okay. Great. Who else do we have? Erin, hi.
I was wondering if you would talk a little bit about practicing gratitude for the body with pain or things like about my ears and my hearing, and then it's just like tinnitus and with pain, with gratitude for the body.
You know, it would be really interesting to try, because you know we have aversion. It's like, you know, we want to move away from all of the. Imagine as if you were a really good mom, like a part of you that can really like, oh, I'm so sorry, you got all that noise going on. Oh, you know, like just like go in as a really good mom. Mm-hmm. Go in with that attitude. And just explore it and see what happens. The body responds. You will be amazed what happens if you keep at it. And it will also, you know, our brains are like a computer, you know, they have these pathways and it's sort of like we reprogram. And so as you develop this practice of appreciating, it will change your brain. And the physical manifestations may shift greatly. And the heart, our emotional life, will shift. No one can give us what we can give ourselves. And Buddha nature is within all of us, is within you. And through gratitude, that Buddha nature starts speaking through much more readily than when we're all, you know, tied up and in conflict. That help?
Very much, yes.
Thank you. We're making great time. We've got plenty of space. Did anybody have a hard time with the meditation? I'm curious to hear if anybody had difficulty with that. I know that you're used to, you know, the Vipassana meditation, and so this is introducing something different. And I just wondered if anybody had difficulty with it. I think Jim Quayle again. Yeah.
Can you hear me? This time it's me.
Yes.
I found it really helpful, and it really resonated with sort of many aspects of where I am. It's my own practice. And one thing I've really been exploring is relationship between body and mind, and the somewhat paradoxical relationship. On one hand, that there's unity of body and mind, but that at the same time in our practice, there's a certain separation. Maybe it's not the right word, but we, you know, and I found that your discussion about embodiment is a way maybe of bridging that, or is it maybe just one of these paradoxes that, you know, I shouldn't try to rationally resolve, but just continue to explore. I don't know. I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, you know, like I said before, this body is the only instrument of perception we have. You know, awakened mind is embodied in this body. And the entire body belongs. It's coming from that source. And some of the ways in which we have inherited all these judgments about the body, those are, you know, distortions of the actual teaching, you know. And I think some of them were, quote unquote, skillful means so that the monks did not get attracted to women or, you know, traditionally. So there was this sort of split of thinking that you could just sort of elevate, you know, excarnate. But we're in a human existence, and to not be afraid to fully embody. And as you experiment the way that I was teaching today, to go through fully recognizing and appreciating the body, and then turning your attention to the one that's perceiving, to that empty cognizance that knows itself, and it's outside of time. It's not in linear time. You can feel the entire body on board, the entire body vibrating. I mean, it's just every cell is awake. When we're in that state of recognition, the whole body is on board, awake, and they work together. We don't excarnate until we're gone, until the body goes. While we're here, we need to be fully here. And the thing is that the body, having that kind of intimacy with the body, is the portal through which we actually receive the support of the whole. If we're half out of the body, we cannot feel the support. In a way, we're not home to receive it. Does this make sense? Thank you. So we probably have room for one more. Daniel?
Hi there. Hi. Thank you so much, Margarita. It's so nice to be able to be here today. And I just wanted to quickly say how moved I am and how much I resonate with this practice of embodiment as part of the doorway of perception as a person who works with the fascia of the body, but also as like a performance artist, and person who's neurodivergent, because for me in school and all this, it's always really hard to just sit there and try to just enter the mind and be able to understand anything. So much of my exchanges with the natural world and others has to do with how I feel everywhere on my body. And in the beginning of my meditation practice, I had this idea that I had to try to leave the body behind. I don't know where I got that concept. And so I've found the few times that I've been able to do this a version of this meditation with you, with the eye, doing these things, I find, and then just not trying to separate out. It feels the most, I feel the most aware of my empathy with all things surrounding me and all beings surrounding me, be able to enter into that. And then also just lastly, my journey in this like trans journey of my body, like even just choosing certain steps to feel more able to feel in my body and enjoy more when you were saying, you know, what an enlightened mind wants to enjoy or something, that really resonates with me too. And it's not a silly joy or anything superficial joy. So I guess I didn't really have a question, but you were asking if it was challenging, but I had the opposite where it was empowering. I feel very moved by that, and then also that these innate wisdoms that I feel like I had when I was young, that I could move back into them now, of like if I want to get up and move, then when I'm meditating I can, I don't have to control myself.
Yeah, I'm so glad you spoke.
Yeah.
You know, we are imprisoned by convention, you know, we suffer so much, you know, and we have swallowed so much from the conventional world that doesn't allow the natural expression of awakened mind. Awakened mind manifests in so many different ways. And so, you know, that's what I was saying, that being aware of what the impact of cultures of domination and what they do to our human soul, you know, there's such a broader sense of possibilities for our own embodiment and how we move in this world and what we offer and how we explore. And, you know, some of us pay high price for not towing the line, you know? And so this meditation of turning towards ourselves and fully appreciating and making room for the truth of our own perception, it's so important, it's freeing, it's empowering. It's a portal to deep understanding. And so as we heal ourselves in our own particular context, then the healing that we obtain, we offer the world. We offer those who struggle with similar things. So, you know, we're always practicing not only for ourselves, we practice for the world. We practice for other beings. And not only the other human beings, we practice for the whole thing. We practice for the minerals. We practice for the earth. We practice for the trees. But we each, you know, we each have our own particular conundrum that we work with. And that is the other thing to say. In Digo Chenzen Rinpoche in Tibetan Buddhism used to say, we need to see ourselves in the center of our own mandala, where every object in our life, from the physical objects to the relationships, to the jobs, to anything, everything that makes our world, is like a symbol teaching us something. And you cannot learn and feel that support until you fully accept your circumstances. And when you accept it, okay, this is what I've got on my plate, now what? So then you use everything that's arising to help you go deeper and deeper and deeper into your own understanding and freedom that then we offer back to the world. So that's a great place to stop.
Thank you.
So I wanted to just say the Shakyamuni's mantra a little bit, because we owe the Buddha so much. All of this is because this human being decided to sit down and challenge, you know, and challenge all the dictums that he had gotten, and to find a way that felt truly genuine and freeing. And so his mantra goes, Om Muni Muni Mahamuni Soha. 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 By the merit generated through a practice together, may all beings come to know their original nature. And may human beings come to full understanding, so that peace, justice, and love prevail in our world. May all beings be free.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.